Barack Obama was raised in part by his white grandparents. The deep love they shared was a source of strength and joy for the former president, but it was not powerful enough to eradicate every bias they held. Obama talked about his grandmother specifically in a 2008 speech.
A woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Stories like Obama's highlight how complicated racial dynamics can be in this country, in particular for mixed-race people, who may be subject to all the prejudice that affects people of color in this country, and find one or both sides of the family ill-equipped to understand the particular challenges of a multiracial identity and unprepared to offer guidance on how to navigate it. Samira K. Mehta is Associate Professor of Women and Gender Studies and of Jewish Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. She's also a biracial person, daughter of a South Asian immigrant father and a native-born white American mother. Her book is called The Racism of People Who Love You, Essays on Mixed Race. Samira, welcome to Think.
Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. You write here that the racism that scares you the most is not the same as the racism that hurts you the most. How are those things different?
I see it in both in systemic terms, right? Like there is structural racism and structural sexism built into the world that I live in that can be terrifying. It can be frustrating, but it's a little bit, it's not exactly that it's depersonalized, right? Because the fear of what might go wrong is really personal. But when people who are total strangers shout at me to go home, I don't know them. It doesn't hurt me the way it hurts me when somebody who I really love dismisses some of those bigger, broader concerns, right? Doesn't understand that those things really shape and affect my life. It doesn't hurt me in the way that it does when someone makes an unconscious comment in front of me, and all of a sudden I realize that there's some sort of gulf between how I see myself and how a loved one sees me, or between how I experience the world and how my loved one experiences the world, and that there's something that they're fundamentally missing and possibly that they harbor, granted a milder version of attitudes that I encounter out in the outside of the world, right? It's personalized. It makes you feel a chasm between you and your loved one, and loved ones can inflict pain.
So one example you share in the book is you were staying with one of your aunts for a while and you came downstairs. It was a warm day and you had this outfit from India that you thought this is the perfect thing to wear. What did your aunt say?
So my aunt said, so you're super ethnic now? And, you know, I don't know. I've never talked to her about it. I didn't talk to her about it in the writing of this book. And I can think of so many things that she might have been thinking. One option is that my aunt is white. The man that she's married to is white. They didn't have kids. So they were both, while I was living with them for the summer, they were both, for the first time, responsible for a younger person. And they were aware that I moved through space differently than they did. There's a pizza place in the city that they live in that I had heard, like, that it was the best pizza in this city. And I'm from New Haven, which takes real pride in its pizza, as I also talk about in the book. And so I always like to try the pizza in other cities, particularly when people are really proud of their pizza. I want to know, right? Like, that's like my heritage food, and I want to know what it's like. And the neighborhood that the pizza place was in was known for being really pretty racist. And my aunt and uncle wanted to honor my desire to go, but they made it really clear that they didn't want me to go by myself. They wanted to take me. It was really clear that they were nervous and worried about taking me. And so one of the most generous sort of interpretations of what was going on for my aunt was that, well, she said it badly. She was thinking, oh my God, what happens when my non-white niece goes out into the world looking foreign? What will happen to her that I can't anticipate and can't protect her from? And again, not only is she, like my mom, a white person thinking about how to raise this person of color and how to protect this person of color and being aware that she doesn't necessarily know, but also she was someone who didn't have kids. And, you know, I also wanted to go to an Indigo Girls concert with a college friend with whom I did all sorts of things because we were both college students without getting permission. And my aunt really like wanted to talk to her and wanted to meet her. And for me, that felt like I'm in high school. Like, again, what are you doing? I've been a grown up living on my own for a year now. What are you doing? But for my aunt, like, she was trying to take care of me. So maybe it was something like that. But less charitable interpretations are things like my white family and I live in really liberal parts of cultures in which there's a lot of exoticization of the East, right? A lot of yoga culture and meditation culture that lifts lightly from a variety of Asian cultures and sometimes sort of irresponsibly and sometimes without a lot of thinking about what it might be like. And in part because of their contact with my dad's family, my mom's family is a little uncomfortable with that, right? So it's possible that my aunt was reacting to me as she might react to a white person who all of a sudden kind of inexplicably chose to put on somebody else's ethnic dress. And in that case, she is absolutely correcting my behavior, but she's forgetting that I have a very different relationship to Indian culture, that this is for me my heritage.
Regardless of what the truth behind that is, first of all, it's a whole lot of emotional energy that you have to expend working through these possibilities. And you note in the book that people of color in families where everybody looks like them, certainly white people, the one thing they have going for them is that they don't have to code switch within their own homes and families. For mixed race people like you, This is a choice you constantly have to make. Is this someone I trust enough to just 100% be myself, or do I need to present a version of myself that makes them comfortable?
Well, and I think that you know, your opening question was, what does it mean to be scared of some things versus hurt by other things? And I think that part of the answer is that it's really painful when there's somebody who you really love and really trust, and all of a sudden, you screw up and don't code switch in front of them, and then some sort of something happens as a result, right? Like, you thought you could let your hair down, and you thought you could really be all of the versions of yourself, and you discover that that's not true. And to be clear, that is an experience that I have as much, or maybe even more, on the Indian side of my family than it is on the white side of my family. Part of the reason that this moment with the Indian clothes was so excruciatingly painful for me, that I remember it, this happened 20 years ago, this story. Part of the reason that it was excruciatingly painful is that I trust, or before this, I trusted that aunt probably beyond anybody except for my mother. And so it would never have occurred to me to code switch in front of her. And that was the moment when I discovered that I had to. And, you know, I ran through two of the options and you were like, this is a lot of emotional labor. I should say that there are two other options, one of which I know is not true, right? One of which I absolutely know is not true. And that is that she's sort of like, well, we can't do anything about your skin, but we can at least control your behavior so that you come across as white. That is not ever what was going on. Whatever it was some sort of deeply unconscious thing that she probably has almost no sort of control over awareness of. And it's still possible. But the reason that it was so painful is that it was a space where I never expected it. I've almost always expected that kind of interaction on the Indian side of my family.
Why do you think it's more common there? And we may just be speaking about your particular family, but why has that been the case?
Well, I think it's really important to say that, you know, in other parts of my life, I'm a scholar and I speak broadly about people's experiences. In this case, I'm really only ever speaking about my own experience. It's been really gratifying as people have read the book to get emails from them or to be told when there are people I know how the book resonates with their experience. So I think that in some ways that also has to do with power. My Indian family, and this is my Indian family in the United States that I'm talking about. In India, it's a little bit different. In the United States, for my immigrant Indian family, I think there are two things that are often going on, not necessarily for my cousins, but I'm the oldest of the American-born cousins. And so I'm really talking about my interactions with my father and his siblings more than with the people in my generation. And so the first thing is, for immigrants, there's a lot of question about, like, how much do I assimilate and adapt to this new culture? And so a real question with kids is, how much do I enforce a kind of behavior on these kids that is actually not the norm in the society that they're living in, right? How much do I make sure that they show respect or act in the home the way they would act if they are Indian children? That tension is like braided into some of my earliest memories of life with my dad's family. And when the kids end up being more American, and again, my sister and I are both the oldest of the American born grandchildren, and also the only mixed race people. And so the question of what was happening because our mother is American and what was happening because we were children being raised in America was really murky for everybody. So there's a lot of pain and question tied into that for immigrant families. I remember one of my aunts saying to me, roughly around when she was pregnant with her first child or was thinking about getting pregnant with her first child, but when I was a teenager, so at a really kind of hard age to hear something like this, she said she knew that American manners were not bad, right? Like that Americans have ways of showing respect that are respectful. But it would make her really sad if her own children showed respect in the American way instead of the Indian way. And I don't even know. Sometimes I do know how to show respect in the Indian way, and sometimes I do it. But sometimes I legitimately don't know, and I make mistakes. Other times, the American way of showing respect and the Indian way of showing respect are actually in direct contradiction to each other. And that can mean several things for me. For me, the Indian way almost never feels like myself. So I know how to do it, but it's not necessarily seamless. So an example here would be in the United States, you show respect by meeting somebody's eyes. Probably every kid in the world, in the United States, not in the world, that's actually my precise point, has been dressed down by somebody who at some point in the dressing down says, look me in the eye when I'm talking to you. In India, you show respect by not meeting the eyes of someone who you should be showing respect to, an elder or something like that. So I know that. But it feels so disrespectful to not look someone in the eye that I'm uncomfortable doing it.
Samira, I'd like to talk a little bit about your father. You grew up close to him. He sounds like a great guy. His identity was tied strongly to being an American. And you write about the fact that when he was dying, your mom said, look, if you want me to go scatter your ashes in India, I'll do that. And by that time, it made absolutely no sense to him to consider something like that.
You know, it was really interesting. I don't write about all of this in the book, but our dog, my family dog, died 3 weeks before my father. And my mom says that it was the last great gift that that dog gave my dad, because my dad had really clear opinions about how the dog's remains be dealt with. And he anointed him with sandalwood and other sort of scented things, as you would in a Hindu cremation. He said a Hindu prayer at the pet cremation facility. And, you know, had the dog, had flowers draped over the dog, all sorts of things that come from Hindu cremation practices. And we did indeed do all of those things for my father, who for most of my life was a really militant atheist. But when my mother said, "Would you like your ash? Would you like me to do this?" My father said to her, "Why would you send me away from my home?" And you know, my mom hasn't actually, my dad's ashes are in my mom's house, not sort of in an urn in a memorial kind of way. But it's interesting, we've never quite figured out what to do. But it became really clear that whatever we did should be something that happened at home, and that for my father, home was possibly specifically Connecticut, but possibly more broadly New England.
So your father certainly would have experienced racism living in this white supremacist society, but he often framed those through a really different lens, different even than the lens that you might see these experiences in.
So, you know, I've read some from other children of immigrants, and I think that for my father, he really believed that a lot of the discrimination that he faced was because he was a foreigner, less than because of the color of his skin. I don't think he was sort of blind to the idea that the color of his skin would be an issue or unaware that the color of his skin would be an issue. But for him, it was the accent, or it was that his entire education happened in a foreign country. And so he didn't have the like alumni networks that people trade off of. Those were things that he could provide my sister and I with, right? We would go to school in the United States. With the publication of this book, I'm actually seeing this as one of my Amazon reviews is from my high school English teacher. I have college friends who are professors all over the country who are kind of trying to get my book into their curriculum in varying ways. And those are networks that we could have because we grew up here. We wouldn't have accents. We wouldn't lack cultural capital. We would never be confused by American culture in ways that he sometimes was. And so he thought, and that's a really common immigrant way to feel. People think of themselves as giving up the comforts of home to move to America to make a better life for their children. But for immigrants who are not white, that also means turning their children into racialized minorities. So first of all, they're coming from countries where they don't have experiences as racialized minorities. And so they're maybe not seeing that one coming in quite the same way. Or at least I don't think my father, who's also a high caste person. So I don't really understand caste, which I write about in the book, but I kind of think of it as something that structures Indian life, not in the same way that race structures American life, but in a maybe analogous way. Mm-hmm. So he's coming from the top of that social system. And you hear about this a lot, people whose parents don't want to think they gave up home in order to turn their kids into racialized minorities. They want to think that they gave up home to give their kids better lives. And that's a really powerful story that they tell themselves. And when you couple that with sort of Asian American model minority myths, which are really problematic in lots of ways. They're problematic in terms of Asian Americans and how they engage with the sort of racialized society in the United States. They're also pretty harmful for Asian Americans themselves. But you know, if they're really the story of if you work hard, if you're good in school, and people will assume that you're good in school, and you'll excel at your, you know, music lessons, and you'll do all of these things, that you're going to be fine. And in some ways, those are true, right? Asian Americans, there aren't a lot of Asian Americans in, for instance, my field in academia, but there are many more than there are of other minority groups in the United States. So there's data to support these sort of beliefs about how the world works. Again, I think they're basically pretty harmful, but my father really was able to buy into those things. But even apart from that, right, he didn't grow up with the kind of skill set as a high caste, middle class person in India. He didn't grow up with the kind of skill set that friends of mine who are African American, you know, talk about having braided into their childhood, right? You talk about the talk that Black parents have to have with their kids. My father wouldn't have grown up with that. And so he wouldn't have known that on September 12th, 2001, my interactions with airport security would be different for a really, really long time, and in some ways forever. Right? Like he wouldn't have had that braided into his childhood in the same way.
When people ask you where you're from, you say New England, and you write that you like it better when there is no follow-up question, right? No, yes, but where are you really from? Talk a little bit about what that follow-up question can mean.
So for me, the follow-up question is really a test for what kind of person I'm dealing with. And my favorite story about this, because it involves a famous person, is that when I was a graduate student at Emory University, Jimmy Carter would come and visit classes at Emory several times during the year. He had this relationship with the university. And so he came to one of my classes, and where I was a teaching assistant, and he had everybody in the room go around the room and say where they were from. So first of all, I loved that because he wasn't singling me out. Everybody in the room was saying where they were from. And when I said that I had been born in New Haven, Connecticut, which is true, I'm actually from a small town right outside of New Haven, but it's a small town, so it doesn't have a hospital. So I was born in New Haven. He said to me, and this is my favorite follow-up question, he said, "Can you explain why they put clams on pizza in New Haven?" And it was so clear that he had been on some stump speech politician experience at some point in his life, and somebody had made him eat the clam pizza as a gesture of hospitality, eat our local delicacy, and he was still wondering why on earth. And I just said, you know, we love it. And so I love follow-up questions when they are follow-up questions that make it feel to me like the person wants to get to know me better, right? Questions about wherever it is that I've just told them that I'm from. Then they're asking me to elaborate on my story as I am telling it. When they say, "No, where are you really from?" what to me they're doing is they're rejecting the version of my story that matters to me, and they're fishing for something else. Now, it turns out that what they're fishing for is also something that to me says, because since you're not white, you can't possibly be American, and you can't possibly be as American as I am, right? Because it's worth noting that basically white people ask this question. And so, you know, you can tell a lot about who someone is. And if you're talking to liberal people, which I kind of have designed my life to live in a little bit of a bubble, right? Like, I'm an academic and I belong to, generally speaking, really progressive religious communities. People are really offended when you say, you know, that question, "I experienced that question as racist," or, you know, "That question implies that the answer can't be I'm an American from the place where I'm born." And they'll say, "Oh, no, I'm just really curious about you. I want to know about your heritage." Like, I love asking people these things. And they maintain that. And if you kind of go around and ask white Americans, like, "Do you get this question?" Redheads will sometimes say yes. People often want to know, it turns out, if redheads are Irish, and, you know, sometimes they are and often they are not. But people will be like, "Oh, no, I ask this of everyone." But then when I go and ask my white friends, like, no, in fact, nobody ever asks them that question again, except occasionally for redheads.
Why is this also sometimes fraught for you when someone with South Asian heritage asks you that "where are you really from" question?
So, you know, I always feel a little bit like a jerk when it's fraught for me, because so often what that person is doing is looking for connection. And, you know, other South Asian Americans usually also don't ask that question, right? Like, if I say, "Oh, I'm from New Haven," they'll say, "Oh, I'm from Augusta, Georgia," right? But immigrants or visitors will ask that. And you know, they're looking for connection. But because in my experience of the Indian community, I'm constantly being told that I'm not Indian enough, right? Like, I'm not super duper good with really, really spicy food. I think cilantro tastes like soap. That combination of things makes Indian food sort of fraught for me. I don't speak Hindi, I don't speak Punjabi, I don't speak Urdu, which are the languages that my family speaks. I also don't speak any other South Asian languages, although, you know, why would I? I'm not Hindu, although there are things that are part of Hindu practice that really matter to me. There are a lot of things I don't understand, and so I get wrong. And so I don't want to say, oh, yes, I'm Indian, and then open myself up to the criticism of not being Indian enough, right? Like, I sometimes think about, I went to India when I was 24, and then the next time I left the United States, like, I spent some time in Europe on my way home from that trip, but the next time I actually, like, got on an airplane and went somewhere else, I went to Japan. And I really liked being in Japan because when I made mistakes, people's operating assumption was that I was foreign and didn't know, rather than that I was being deliberately rude. And so when South Asian people ask me, I always like have this reaction of like, look, let's just agree that I'm American. And so I'm not going to be good and fully culturally competent at being South Asian, rather than you forcing me to admit a heritage that shapes how I look and it shapes my genetics, but it doesn't provide me with intricate knowledge about how not to offend you. Right, like let's all agree that if I offend you, I probably did it by mistake rather than deliberately and on purpose to be disrespectful. But please let me give you the information about myself that will lead to that conclusion. Like if I'm being rude to you, I'm being rude to you in English in a way that would strike Americans as rude.
Do you feel like as a mixed race person, your boundaries are more often policed than those of folks who have one racial background?
It's really hard for me to say. Every now and then, I have a couple of really good friends or really close colleagues who are South Asian and not mixed race, but who are South Asian American. And sometimes they have really interesting stories about spending time in India and discovering ways in which they're, you know, things that their parents like deliberately left out of their American education because they didn't like them. A friend of mine has some really impressive stories about menstrual taboos that she encountered the first time that she went to India as somebody who menstruated. So sometimes those stories are stories that immigrant kids have. And I wouldn't be surprised to learn that sometimes those are stories or experiences that transracial adoptees might also have, although I don't know as much about that. I don't have, sort of in my adult world, I know fewer transracial adoptees that I can talk to about that as like peer-to-peer. But I do think that there are sort of that policing starts really young and can be really confusing if you are mixed race. Or maybe actually if you're mixed culture, like I kind of wonder if one of your parents is American and the other parent is Norwegian and both of them are white, that might happen in that setting too, in which the rules for behavior are really different on the different sides of your family. And so behavior that is praised in one place might be sort of against the rules. Like code switching isn't an inborn skill, it's a learned skill. And I think that many people learn it when they experience consequences for failing to code switch. And so I think that that's kind of an early and painful situation that at least for me has made me trepidatious about getting it wrong in adult spaces. And also I came of age in the 1990s when a particular kind of identity politics was really at the forefront. And so when I got to college, many of my peers policed my mixed race, sort of things that thought of me as being somebody who wanted to be white or who was sort of overly assimilated, when in fact the answer is my father worked really, really long hours and my mother ran our home. And so our home was run by a white American woman My mother had the first chapter of the Wizard of Oz memorized for most of my, probably still does, because I loved that story so much. But I don't know what the equivalent story from India would be, right? And like, that's just who was involved. So that kind of identity policing is different from family identity policing. That was a kind of peer identity policing that was really prevalent during the years that I was in college in the United States. It's a little bit less, I think it's probably a little bit less prevalent now as there are more mixed race people running around in sort of their young adulthood phase of life. But I don't actually know. That's not the kind of conversation that I have with my students.
Samira, you open your essay on authenticity by admitting you're aware that you don't pronounce your own last name precisely the way it's meant to be pronounced. I'm going to assume here that I don't do so either. You can hear the difference, but you can't always produce the sound you know is right. How does even your name function as a kind of shibboleth sometimes to Indian people that you meet?
So one of the things that is funny about my name is that my name, the sort of my first name and my last name are very clearly Indian. My middle names are Catherine and Hotchkiss, which are both my maternal grandmother's name is Catherine Hotchkiss. And Catherine is my mother's middle name and Hotchkiss is my mother's maiden name. So that's kind of inherently funny, right? Like, when I write my name, when I sign something, the American names are just one middle initial. And so they sort of disappear. But my last name is spelled M-E-H-T-A. And that H-T is a kind of T. It's the way that in English we render a T sound that we do not actually have in our language, right? And so I, again, can hear it. I can't make it for you right now on the radio, but it's kind of like da, da. And the way that it comes across, like if I were to, that's a little bit overemphasized for how it would sound in sort of my name, right? It's like if I went, that's not actually what happens when someone says the word tomato, right? And so I can do that. I can do the sort of overemphasized version, but it's this light little touch that comes up. I say my last name Mehta, but there's something in that T that a native speaker of Hindi or Urdu would do that I can't do. And so in the instant I say my name, people either make one of two assumptions. And one assumption is that I'm deliberately anglicizing it, which can be like people will have different political feelings about that, about assimilation or, right, like lots of people feel the right to correct me. Or people will immediately know that I'm a native English speaker and that I'm not like fluent in both languages, that even if I turn out to be Or even if I turn out to be fluent in one of those South Asian languages, which I'm not, but even if I were to, I would turn out to be sort of somebody who learned it later in life, and it would be evidence of speaking with a really heavy accent in that language, a really heavy American accent.
It must be frustrating that anybody feels the right to tell any individual person that they are saying their name wrong.
So this is my favorite thing to say to you because you're an NPR affiliate. NPR has an anchor, a news reporter named Lakshmi Singh. And Lakshmi Singh was interviewed at some point. I've never met Lakshmi Singh. I, of course, feel like I have met her the way that we all feel like we have met the people who are on All Things Considered. But I have never met her. I don't know what she looks like because, of course, it's the radio. But she was interviewed once about her name, and that name from a sort of Indian South Asian perspective would be pronounced Lakshmi, not Lakshmi. And this apparently is something that she'll hear from South Asians, and her family is, I don't remember where, I didn't realize I was going to say this to you, and so I don't remember where her family is from, but they're not immediately from South Asia. There was another sort of, they went from South Asia to somewhere else, and then she came here. And she has always assumed that it's that other place that her family is from that is why her name is pronounced that way, but it's her name. It's that's how what her parents called her. So you can never be wrong about your own name. And so for that interview, she's one of my very favorite people on the news. I feel this deep kinship to her, this person I've never met, because like your name is your name. You don't get to tell me that I say my name wrong. You can tell me how you say your name, and you can express a preference for my trying it. But like, you know, I don't mind when native Hindi or Urdu speakers pronounce my name in that way that is different than I do. Like, I understand that. I also don't mind when Spanish speakers roll the R in my name. We all speak differently. You know, it's possible that, I don't know, were I to marry a native Spanish speaker, I would want them to learn to say my name the way that my family says it. And it's possible that I would be deeply in love with the way that they pronounced my name, right? Everyone has an accent. Accents aren't wrong. Accents can be more or less precise to a particular geographic location. And when you are teaching French in a high school French class, you might strive to get your American students to sound like they can speak Parisian French. But speaking Parisian French is not more or less correct than speaking Montreal, like Quebecois. It's not more or less correct than speaking the French of Provence, right? My accent is not less correct than an English accent. It's just an American one.
I mean, hearing you describe these experiences and reading the book, Samira, it makes me realize, I mean, it's difficult to even agree on what authenticity means, let alone achieve it. We say it's something that we're all striving for. I wonder why we hold it so sacred. Is it ultimately a way for all kinds of people to include all kinds of other people, or rather exclude all kinds of other people and things that somehow just don't match our expectations or our preferences?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think authenticity just it means lots of different things. And you can see this in my essay. I sort of threaded the essay through Oxford English Dictionary definitions of the word authentic. But I guess I have sort of two thoughts about this. And one is, I was talking to a friend who's an English professor about the Shakespeare quote, "To thine own self be true," which is sort of a definition of authenticity. And what I should have known, because I'm an English major and I took a lot of Shakespeare, but what I had forgotten is that it's a line from Polonius. Polonius says that, and Polonius is not an admirable character, right? So what Polonius is means in kind of in the context of the play, you know, there are lots of ways of interpreting Shakespeare, but it's almost never how it gets interpreted when it gets slapped on a mug, right? Which is like, follow your star, be yourself. And so I liked that, right? Like, even in this kind of quote that people use to tell you to be your most authentic self, there's something sort of off about the distance between the quote and the source from which it's been extracted. But the other thing is, me being whatever that North Star true authentic self is, even in a world in which that exists, is a self that is an American raised person who, on the one side of my family, has people, white people who have been here since the 1600s, and on the other side, has brown people who got here in the 1970s and 1980s. And it wouldn't be following my own North Star to do Indianness in a way that is replicated by India. And, you know, I know people who are the children of Indian immigrants, and sometimes who are mixed race, who I think kind of romanticize it in ways that look sort of like when white people are like, oh, Indian culture is so exotic. And I know people who do that. And that isn't, that does, that feels kind of gross to me. And, you know, some of my friends who are Indian immigrants also like will sort of be like, that's always a little weird. But like for maybe for those people, that feels like this voyage of discovery, and it is authentic to them, right? Like, these are complicated questions, how you do these things. But The other thing that I always think about is like, what would feel authentically Indian to my father was really out of date. My father moved here in roughly 1970. He went to India once, right around when he and my mother got married, which was just a few years later. He went once in the late 80s when my grandfather got really sick. And then he went a couple of times in sort of the early 2000s. He went once in 2001, and then he went, I think, two times sort of closer to when he died, maybe around 2005 or 2006. But that was it. And India, of course, changed a huge amount. The United States changed a huge amount, right, in that time period. So the India that really felt right to him was an India of the 1960s. And so that would be like my mother saying, okay, you have to wear, I don't know, you have to dress like a flower child all of the time, or you have to dress like, the cast of Bewitched, or now I'm getting my like sort of fashion backwards, right? My mother grew up in the 1950s. You must dress like Doris Day all of the time, right? That's not how culture works. And so the India that my father remembers is not the India that would be available for me to get on an airplane and go visit. It's not the India that his siblings who continued to live in India were living in. Attitudes around gender. Think about this. Attitudes around gender in the United States changed hugely between 1970, when my father got here, and now, right? Attitudes about gender in India, one assumes, also have changed. Attitudes about, you know, consumption change in cultures over time, right? Like what's fashionable, what's accepted. And so what is the authentic India that I'm trying to get to? Is it the India that my father left behind? Is it the India that his friends left behind? Is it the India that I could get to if I got on an airplane right now? Is it the India that I experienced when I visited for 3 months 20 years ago? And what's authentic America? To me, authentic America is always going to be New England, where I'm from. That's a really different place than Colorado, where I live. And that's a really different place than Illinois, where my mother grew up, or one of my closest friends is from Texas, where you're broadcasting from. We all had really different experiences of America, and India is also a really big country with a lot of different cultures in it, right? So like authentic Indian food, authentic American food to me is pizza with clams on it.
Before I let you go, do you have any brief advice for people who have family members who don't look like them, don't come from the same racial, precisely the same racial or cultural backgrounds, about not assuming that because they love their relative, they can't possibly say or do or think things that hurt that person?
Not only are there different expectations at play, but those different expectations might be painful to you. If you're a white person moving through a society that was designed for you in a way that it wasn't designed for people of color. And so you've got all of these sort of things that you don't think to notice. Like my favorite example of this is a fight that I had with my mom. My mother lives an hour from any airport. So I would fly home to visit, and I really want to be at the airport 2 hours ahead of time. And so I would get a flight and I would tell my mom, my flight is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I would want to leave at 11. And my mom would be like, we've got an hour. My mom thinks you need to be at an airport an hour before. My mom would be like, we have an hour. What happens when I go to the airport and the line is long is that I get like sometimes, you know how they'll pull people out so they don't miss their flights. If I ask for that, I get yelled at. I have to assume that this might be the day that someone is going to go through my entire bag and they're not going to hold the flight for me. When I traveled with my mother, I was both a child and in the care of a white woman, and people didn't do that to me. It was also before September 11th. And so my mother will forget that for me, getting to the airport an hour and 45 minutes ahead of a flight is late. But I was like, why is my mother setting me up for harassment at the airport? And my mother was like, totally unaware that that was what she was doing.
Samira K. Mehta is Associate Professor of Women and Gender Studies and of Jewish Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. Her book is The Racism of People Who Love You, Essays on Mixed Race Belonging. Samira, thanks very much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can find our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe. If you listen at our website, you can also sign up there for our free e-newsletter. That's at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.